Good afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome to the 22nd annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. I am Eugene Meyer, President of the Society. This memorial lecture started shortly after 9/11. Sadly, as many of you know, Ted Olson passed away suddenly 2 days ago. Ted was a giant of the legal profession, a once-in-a-generation lawyer. He did much in his distinguished legal career and much for the Federalist Society. He was a speaker at our very first conference in 1982. He and Barbara hosted thousands of students, probably including quite a few of you in this room, at their summer barbecues over a decade. He served on our Board of Visitors for years. He was head of our DC Lawyers Chapter also for years. And he spoke up for the Society and explained its true nature countless times when we were being attacked in the press. He was a fundamentally courageous and honest man, and we are grateful for so much of what he did for us and deeply saddened by his passing. Can I request a moment of silence in his honor? Thank you. Now, our speaker today is an appropriate one for this lecture, and one whom Ted was very pleased was doing it. Ted's inaugural lecture reminded us of what it means to be an American and how our legal tradition is a critical part of our identity as Americans. We have wanted this lecture series to remind lawyers of so many of the principles we care deeply about, so that they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. Some of our other lecturers have included Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Vice President Cheney, and Judges Starr, Bork, Randolph, Jones, Doug Ginsburg, Jacobs, Sutton, and then Judge, now Justice, and our speaker, one of our speakers last night, Neil Gorsuch. Former Attorney Generals Bill Barr and Michael Mukasey, former White House Counsel Don McGahn, Peter Thiel, John Ellison, and Senators Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse, and last year's memorial lecture by Barry Weiss. Today, we're honored to have Professor Jonathan Turley, who has for years been one of our country's leading defenders of free speech, a cause with Ted and Barbara Olson wholeheartedly agreed. Turley's recent book on the indispensable right, free speech in the age of rage, is extremely timely, and we are delighted he'll be signing copies of it right after his lecture. He is a nationally recognized legal scholar who has written extensively in areas ranging from constitutional law to legal theory to tort law. He's been a member of the GW faculty since 1980. He's been published in numerous major law reviews, and his articles have appeared in every major paper in the country. Likewise, he's been a legal commentator on CBS, NBC, ABC, and most recently, Fox. He's been counsel to members of Congress, judges, whistleblowers, et cetera, in some of the most notable cases in the last two decades. He served as a consultant on Homeland Security and constitutional issues, and is a frequent witness before the House and Senate on constitutional and statutory issues, as well as tort reform legislation. Now, he's been both a strong academic and a major contributor to the public policy debate. More than 400 of his articles on legal and policy issues appear regularly in national newspapers. In all his these activities, he's always been forthright about his views, wherever they may lead, and has made vital contributions to the public policy debate. We are truly delighted to have Professor Turley, especially at this time, deliver the Barbara Olson Lecture. Professor Turley.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. Thank you, Gene. It is It's obviously a bittersweet occasion with the passing of Ted Olson. It is really astonishing to even think that it's been almost 25 years since the passing of Barbara, who many of us knew and worked with. I cherished my friendship with Barbara, and her loss and now the loss of Ted Olson has left a great hole in our profession. Ted was a towering figure. He was the person that presidents and members of Congress called at some of our most trying moments. He was the one who picked up the phone. Of course, two of those calls on September 11th were from Barbara, who was trapped on Flight 77. And he spoke with her to the very end of her life. That phone is now in the National Museum of American History. Knowing Ted, working with Barbara, was one of the great privileges of my life. Now, I am going to try to move beyond that and talk about free speech. I think that, let me see if my, there we go. So, free speech is an immense subject, and we have about 40 minutes to talk about it. So, rest assured, as Henry VIII said to Anne Boleyn, I shall not keep you long. You know, free speech, this book took about 30 years in the making until Simon & Schuster finally said, you actually have to release the book for people to read it. And what prompted me to finally let go, because there are wonderful free speech books out there, and I didn't want to write just another one. I wanted to try to drill down on why we're still struggling with free speech after so many years. And I felt that the time was needed for a new book because, first of all, when this book came out, four other books came out that were decidedly anti-free speech. The book's subtitle is Free Speech in an Age of Rage, not the Age of Rage. And the reason is that this country was born in rage. Rage rhetoric has been part of our politics since the very beginning. The Boston Tea Party was an act of rage. It's celebrated. And that's a strange thing about rage. When you agree with it, it's righteous. And when you don't, it's dangerous. We are living in an age of rage. Now, rage is a strange thing that I talk about in the book. It's liberating, even addictive. It allows people to say and do things that they would not ordinarily say and do. When I was covering the Trump trial in Manhattan, I was taken aback on both sides to see the face of rage and how liberating it really is, what a license it gives to people to do things that they would not ordinarily do. The problem with rage rhetoric that I discuss in the book is that it often triggers state rage, where the government comes in and uses censorship, blacklisting, and arrests to engage in sedition prosecutions. Now, I'm going to confirm what my students have said every year, that I can't speak for 5 minutes without mentioning James Madison. And I will now fulfill that. In 1800, Madison wrote an amazing paper in which he talked about speech prosecutions, and he referred to them as the monster. And I was really taken aback by that reference because it's so apt. Speech prosecutions are the monster that lives within our body politics, and we release it when we're very afraid or very angry. We release it on each other. Madison, I think, hoped that he had finally slayed the monster, but of course he did not. What is the grounds for his hope was language in the First Amendment that had never been uttered before, that protected free speech in the most absolute terms that had ever been written before. It was arguably the most revolutionary part of the American Revolution. And it was certainly the greatest departure from Great Britain of anything the framers did. It was astonishing what a break it was, because the British have never been particularly good on free speech. Indeed, the Star Chamber that people often talk about was a speech prosecution forum. The king had tried to charge critics with treason, and even though the British judges were often quite eager to give the crown what it wanted, they actually objected to treason, because treason had elements. And they said, we can't make the elements work. Not with this, not with making a joke about the queen or some other comment about the king. So the solution was to create the Star Chamber and to create the crime of sedition. So the language of the First Amendment was revolutionary at its time, but it still is revolutionary. One of my colleagues is leading a very popular movement to amend the First Amendment. She says the First Amendment is too aggressively individualistic and argues that it should be balanced against concepts like equity. She actually has language that she has proposed. So we've never really slayed Madison's monster. And we are living in the most dangerous anti-free speech period that I discuss in the book. We've never faced an alliance like the one we have today, of the government, the media, academia, corporations. Two of those have historically been supporters of free speech. We saw the creation of the largest censorship system in history. We have law professors leading this effort. We have a University of Michigan law professor just published a book, same time I did, calling the First Amendment the Achilles heel of the United States, the thing that endangers us. The Washington Post just ran a column by another law professor that said that the First Amendment was now threatening our very existence, our livelihoods, our lives. And suddenly, we are raising a generation of speech phobics who have been told that they should not be triggered by opposing views. This book tries to figure out why we're still struggling with this concept, how we are still in the same place where we began. It's an unvarnished history, because we're not always as good as our advertising. But the title is taken from the Whitney case by one of the greatest civil libertarians in history, Louis Brandeis. I believe his birthday was just yesterday. And in that opinion, he wrote beautifully about free speech and called it the indispensable right. Now, the reason I wanted to use that in the title is to capture not just the irony, but the danger of how we approach free speech. Because in that opinion, Brandeis signed off on the conviction and sentencing of Charlotte Anita Whitney, who was charged with giving a speech against lynching. So one of the great civil libertarians in history signed off on one of the most despicable convictions in history. We all agree that free speech is indispensable. We just can't agree why. And this book tries to look at that. It looks at how our views of free speech have been shaped by the personalities and periods of our history, people like Whitney. So when you look back at this, you realize that as soon as we wrote the First Amendment, we sort of lost our way. Even our allies, like the Marquis de Lafayette, when he went to France to contribute to the Declaration of the Rights of Man, he wrote a provision of free speech that sort of reads like ours. But instead of a period, he put a comma, that it would be a right that would be enjoyed as long as it did not trouble the public order established by law, which of course defeats the purpose. So then, why is it that we are struggling? And for that, you've got to go back. And this book goes back to some of the first protections of free speech in ancient Greece. And it goes back to one of the most influential philosophers for the framers, John Locke. Locke believed in a natural law. He believed that there were certain rights that belonged to human beings because we are human. They didn't establish themselves with the government when we left the state of nature. They existed in the state of nature, but they were recognized and protected after we created civil society. And he mixed this concept with his idea of private property, that God created everything in common, but that when you mixed your labor with it, you took what was in common and made it your own. It's called the labor theory. I often ask my students when I teach Locke, why would God do that? Locke believed it did belong to us as private property that's not defined by government, that is based in a divine gift. Why would he say all things are in common? Sometimes I show them this picture, which you'll recognize from the Sistine Chapel. More of my colleagues have gotten tenure based on this picture than any others. Thousands have studied this picture, specifically studied that. It's called the touch. What does it mean, the touch? Now, many people say, look, that's creation. That's the gift of life. After all, this is a panel described as God creates Adam. So that's the spark of life. I often ask my students, what if it's something other than that? Not just life. Now, one interesting study was done by a medical professor who was on vacation visiting the Vatican and looked up, took his usual picture, and was walking away when he stopped and looked back again. And he said, that's odd. And his wife said, what? He said, behind God. That's the human brain. And this doctor said, that's the exact shape of the human brain. And he went back and he compared it. And it is astonishing how similar the shape is. Now, keep in mind, Michelangelo would dissect human beings. That's how he became such a great artist. He knew what the human brain looked like. So if he really wanted to superimpose God on the human brain, why would he do that? Now, some people might suggest that's because this was really a secularist who was making a statement about religion. I don't think that's true. Now, I may have a slightly odd explanation, but Michelangelo is nowhere to contradict me. And when it comes to tenure, that's all you need. So, what if that goes back to the touch? What if the touch was more than just life? What if the touch was God giving humanity the ability to create? After all, man was in the image of the creator. What is a creator but someone who can create? What if the touch was about giving human beings the ability to be creators? And that perhaps the human brain behind the God, behind the image of God, was indeed a statement of a different kind. The divinity of humanity is in the essence of who we are. It is the fact that we are creators, that we can't help but create. When I teach this subject in my class, I often walk around and I find a student doodling, which is always the case. And the student freaks out. I say, are you doodling? And they go, oh, no, I'm sorry, I was listening. And I go, I don't care whether you're doodling. Doodling is cool, doodling is great. Everyone doodles. People doodle at weddings, people doodle at funerals. People doodle with a goat in a boat. They doodle everywhere. And oftentimes they doodle in the most nonsensical ways. They'll do geometric shapes that get more and more bizarre. Why? Why do people doodle? It's such a useless act. And it may be because we can't even stand still without creating. It's not just the Great Wall of China. It's the little things like doodling. We do have a spark of creation. Now, many things in our culture reflect that, right? The whole image of a starving artist who literally will give up food. Van Gogh gave up money for food so he could buy canvas. At certain points, he was starving, and he gave his money for food to buy canvas. Why? That's the most basic impulse there is, survival. So there's something about human beings that demand expression, that to project part of ourselves in the world around us. Now, the question then is, what is it to be human? You know, the fact is that parts of the human brain are just wired for expression. We're built for expression. The frontal lobe, the neocortex, is built for expression. What does that say about who we are and what we are intended to be? Do you know that we share 98.7% of our DNA with chimpanzees? Isn't that amazing? 98.7? Here's what will blow your mind. We share 61% of our DNA with fruit flies. We share 60% of our DNA with a banana. So does that just make us a talking banana? Does that make us banana 2.0? What is the difference between us and a banana, a fruit fly, a chimpanzee? Now, that is hard to answer, but actually science has partially an answer. Many of you may recognize this as from your high school classes. This is Phineas Gage. I got this picture from Harvard. Harvard Medical School was wonderful in helping me with this, but they wanted me actually, they were so bummed because they have all the pictures of Phineas Gage, but they really wanted me to publish the entrance wound for Phineas Gage. These doctors were delighted that they could show the entry wound. I didn't think Simon Schuster was as happy with that. So we went with this. Now, in case many of you don't remember, Phineas Gage was a railroad supervisor, and it came to him to blow rock out of the way. So they would drill holes in a rock face, they'd stuff it with dynamite, and then he would use a tamping iron, that tamping iron. And he would tamp it down, and then you'd put a wire in it, then you'd go a safe distance, and you would blow the rock. The problem is on this occasion, he was just a little bit incautious. And when he tamped it down, it sparked. And it blew that tamping iron through his head. Blew off much of the front of his head. Now, the doctor, when he heard about this, didn't rush to the scene. He figured this would be a burial case. He was astonished when he got there and Phineas Gage was chatting away. He actually was making notes in a notebook. And then this doctor had a brilliant thought. He realized that we had no idea what the front of the human brain does, but that guy doesn't have one anymore. And if I could figure out what he was like before and what he's like afterwards, maybe we could figure out what the cerebral cortex did. And what he observed was really quite astonishing. Phineas Gage became more animal-like. That's the description of his former friends. They said he was easy to excite. Anger. He would fight. He had a hard time with relationships. He had a hard time expressing himself. He had a hard time doing anything except the most immediate types of things of pleasure or need. Some people described him as an animal. The very thing that made him human seemed to have been blown away by the tamping iron. And we now know that many of the parts of that brain are indeed forms, areas that where we fashion our projections, our expression. We also know, as the book talks about, from scientific studies, that if you don't use parts of the brain, they physically change. The hippocampus is a good example of that. It actually shrinks. So in studies of prisoners in segregation, explorers cut off, when they were unable to express themselves, parts of their brain changed physically. We're hardwired for expression. So that brings us back to Whitney. Whitney was an extraordinary person. She was brave. She, in my view, reached the wrong conclusions, but I respect why she did it. She was a student at Wellesley, came from one of the best families in America. She traced her family back to, I think she said, four families on the Mayflower, which confirms the level of inbreeding. But it also, she was also just part of the establishment of the United States. She was the niece of Cyrus W. Field, one of the longest standing justices on the Supreme Court. She'd spent every summer with Justice Field. And she was at Wellesley when she went to go on a field trip to a settlement house in New York. It was just be for a couple days. She stayed for 4 months. She had never seen poverty like that and suffering like that. And she wanted to do something about it. And that's what I respect about her. Now, she ultimately became one of America's first communists. But she also fought for women's suffrage, and she fought against lynching and segregation. And when the time came for her to speak on this fateful day that led to her arrest, they told her, if you speak again against lynchings, we'll arrest you, and there's an officer standing right behind you. And she gave the same speech. This woman who knew nothing but privilege stood her ground and gave the same speech. And ultimately, she went in front of two of the greatest civil libertarians in history, Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes, and they sent her along her way to jail. Her speech was not considered protected. Now, part of the reason is because we had this moment of clarity at the beginning of the Republic, that Lockean period, where many of the framers viewed our rights as natural rights. That's captured in the Declaration of Independence more than the Constitution. We're approaching that anniversary. I'm actually writing a book I'm going to have out in 2025 on that. I used to call it my Project 2025, but but I decided recently I didn't like it. But anyway, I digress. But you know, the fact is that at the beginning of our time as a republic, we had this moment of clarity where we did recognize, in my view, I think most of the framers recognize, free speech as one of those natural rights. That's a great debate that academics continue to have. I respect many on the other side that suggest that that's not so clear. I think that there's support for that. But many did. But that moment of clarity was lost very soon with the Federalist judges. And they started to, of course, with John Adams, arrest people for sedition. And the judges adopted what I call a functionalist approach to free speech. And it goes something like this, and you probably heard it before, is that we protect free speech because it serves a function of supporting a democracy. And you see this in a lot of opinions of the Supreme Court. And so free speech is necessary to perfect a democracy. Now, that's certainly true. It's that and much more. But if you say that free speech is protected for its function, it allows you endless trade-offs. It allows you to say some speech is not so functional or essential to democracy. It allows you to trade off good and bad speech. We've been on that slippery slope for decades. That is opposed to a view of free speech as a natural right, as an autonomous right, as a right that belongs to us as humans because we cannot be fully human without it. And we face that moment when we face Whitney. You know, George Bernard Shaw said that unreasonable people are people who expect the world to conform to them. And he said that's why all history is made by unreasonable people. Whitney was a gloriously unreasonable person. This book is about incredibly unreasonable people who just would not shut up. And we owe them a great debt. We owe them the debt to bring the meaning of that to life. Congress shall make no law abridging free speech. No comma. That's it. There's no real ambiguity there. Indeed, I sort of like what Hugo Black said, that I take no law abridging to mean no law abridging. Now, the fact is, that view was lost by some of the very framers that worked with Madison. John Adams was one of the great hypocrites of free speech in our history. He abandoned everything he believed in the Revolution. He became a monster. Jefferson was better. He pardoned all the people convicted under Adams, but after all, they were Jeffersonians. But he did prosecute some, not as many as Adams. The only framer, and this is going to drive my students crazy, who was actually up to this test was James Madison, who viewed what they were doing as unleashing that monster. Now, the book takes a curious turn at one point when I talk not about constitutional interpretation, but artistic interpretation. You see, I talk about this painting. Now, Norman Rockwell was inspired when FDR gave his Four Freedoms speech to rally the nation before World War II. He wanted to paint it. And the first one he painted was free speech. But he chose a subject that surprised many. He chose a neighbor by the name of Jim Egerton, who actually was the great-grandson of a hero of the American Revolution. But he was just a small dairy farmer in Vermont. And Rockwell saw him at a meeting where they were going to build a new public school, which was enormously popular. And everyone passed this by acclamation until one person stood up. He stood up. And he said, I've had a bad year. All of us have. Some of us won't keep our farms. We can't make payments. I know I can't. Where are we going to get the money when we build this school? Because I don't have any money. I want to keep my farm. Rockwell was so moved by this one person standing up and speaking boldly against everyone else. He painted him as the very symbol of free speech. Now, as I say in the book, when it comes to constitutional interpretation, I am unapologetically Rockwellian. I happen to like Rockwell a lot as an artist, but that was not shared. Rockwell, when he painted this, and then in the years that followed, was attacked by art critics as simplistic. Probably the most vocal was at the New Yorker with Clement Greenberg. Now, Greenberg was the guy that discovered Jackson Pollock. And he, with every article he wrote about Jackson Pollock in abstract art, he wrote an article blasting Rockwell. Rockwell to him was an absolute grotesque presence in the art community. He said, Rockwell has chosen not to be taken seriously. And he pointed to Jackson Pollock as what it means to be a serious artist. Rockwell never responded to Greenberg, not in writing. He responded with this. Now, this is called the connoisseur. Okay. Now, the connoisseur is a magnificent piece. And like most Rockwell pieces, you have to look at it for a while. You see, it shows a man with an art magazine rolled tightly in his hand, staring what seems to have been a long time at an abstract painting. You get the feeling from his posture that he's just looking for meaning. And it was Rockwell's answer to Greenberg and Jackson Pollock. What was interesting at this unveiling, you had William de Kooning, who's probably more famous as an abstract artist at his time. And when it was unveiled, he screamed, "My God, that's better than Pollock." And he actually got a critic to get a magnifying glass, and they went up, and he said, "This is one of the finest abstract paintings I have ever seen." So Rockwell was saying, "I can do that." And he could. He went to all the great art schools. But he didn't want to. He said once that he went through America and he wanted to share what he saw, but he felt that his contemporaries were missing, that there was a certain magnificence, a majesty about America. And he wanted to capture what he was seeing. Most people that saw the Rockwell paintings didn't think that they were simplistic. They thought they were profound. And that sort of gets to my point. Today, I'm often called a free speech absolutist. There was a time when that was a compliment. But I'm actually not. There are limits on free speech. But we live in a time of constitutional connoisseurs, academics who say, you've decided not to be taken seriously if you just take those words as they're written. They can't mean that. And so we have the new constitutional connoisseurs saying it's far more nuanced. Some speech is just simply functionally not necessary, even harmful. Disinformation, misinformation, my favorite, malinformation. Malinformation, by the way, by the Biden administration, is defined as information that's true that has been used in a misleading way. Because that's a standard I can't imagine the government abusing. So we now have these connoisseurs that stand between us and the language the framers gave us to tell us what it means. It sort of reminded me there was an old cartoon in 1950 in the New Yorker, and it showed two women sitting on a bench staring at an abstract painting. And one turned to the other and said, "God, I wish there was a bench in front of a painting we could understand." You can understand the First Amendment. The framers understood it. It actually takes a lot to come up with a different meaning. It's like Dolly Parton saying, "It takes a lot of money to make this wig look so cheap." Okay? It actually is magnificent. It's Rockwellian. It's profound. There's nothing simplistic about it. Now, I know I'm running out of time, as you can see me throwing pages to the wind. So how does this end, I think, is what you want to know. And the answer is, buy the damn book. No, you invited me, you gave me coffee, I'll tell you. You know, actually, I'll tell you, what was interesting is that I was giving a speech in Colorado, and this really nice lady came up before the speech. It made me feel really bad. And she said, "I read your book. Could you say something positive?" And I was like, "Oh my God, I thought it was positive." And she's like, "Yeah." So I sort of feel like Woody Allen when someone said, "We'd like you to end your speech on a positive note." And he says, "I actually don't do positive." And so he said, "Could I give you two negatives to make a positive?" So maybe I'll give you two negatives to make a positive and we'll call it a day. The first one is, it's not working. The censorship isn't working. We have the greatest censorship system in the history of this country, and it's not working. Yes, we have polls showing that young people are more likely to recognize restrictions on speech, but it's not enough. It's gone up a couple of points. You need more than that. It's not easy to get a free people to give up freedom. It's a lot harder than you think. This election may have proven that. You can say that you're saving democracy, but people aren't chumps, right? You have to show that you're saving democracy, and you don't do it by tearing it down. But it's not working. One of the things the book asks is, point to a single censorship system in history that's worked. Have you ever wondered about that? There's not one. There has never been a censorship system in history that has actually worked. Why? You know, in Germany, they've one of the oldest censorship systems on the books. I talked years ago to a bunch of German academics about free speech. And I said, how's it going for you? How's it working out? You've been doing censorship full-fledged censorship since World War II. How's it working out? Because I turn on the TV and there's tens of thousands of neo-Nazis marching in your cities. They're having a banner year. And you're arresting people on subways because they have a Hitler ringtone. That's an actual case. So how is it working for you? I'll tell you how it's working. There was a poll done last year that showed that only 17% of Germans felt comfortable speaking publicly about their values. 17%. So you're silencing the wrong people. The neo-Nazis are having a field day, literally, and citizens are being silenced. But maybe that's the point. Censorship systems never do work, but they achieve what governments want, which is control. To control speech. But it's never worked. The second negative is this. The reason it hasn't worked is because if some of us are right that free speech is an autonomous right, a human right, the thing that makes us fully human, then you can't kill it without killing us. It's just not possible. It's in our DNA. It's who we are. It's like water. It'll find its way out because we have to have free expression. So the fact is, we are living in an age of rage, but it's not the rage that defines us. It's free speech that defines us. And in the end, I think a free people will not give up that freedom. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Turley, for that wonderful lecture. And as I mentioned before, he'll be signing books, and also our reception. Both are there, going straight out the door. And is it up or down the stairs? Up the stairs, and that will all be there. So thank you all for attending. Let's enjoy the reception, and thank you again, Professor.